Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The goal of a conversation is to understand what the other person is trying to tell you and to speak in such a way that they can understand you. Then by virtue of that, I'm going to adopt some of your lens. I'm going to at least see the world through your lens. That doesn't mean that I agree with your lens, and it doesn't mean that I'm going to walk away and we're going to have found common ground. But as long as I understand how you see the world and I get you to understand how I see the world, then that conversation is a success.
On this episode of the Psychology Podcast, I talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and best-selling author Charles Duhigg. The topic of this conversation is super communicators. Super communicators are exactly what it sounds like. Super communicators. Charles breaks down the characteristics of super communicators and teaches us how we can all become a better super communicator. We also discuss why some conversations succeed and some fail, and the three main types of conversations. I also enjoy chatting about how we can connect with others who we disagree with, a topic I think is really important in this day and age. I really enjoyed this chat and learned a lot that I can apply in my life right away. So without further ado, I bring you Charles Duhigg. Hey, Charles. Wow, welcome back to the Psychology Podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
I was checking. The last time you were on was 2016.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So it's been a little while. It's time flies.
Imagine we both look different.
At least a little bit.
A little, like, mildly. I don't think you had that beard last time.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
I don't know.
It's, the pandemic, it took a lot out of all of us. So
For sure.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. You may have had a beard. It was a long time ago. But I am so proud of you and happy for you for this new book.
Thanks.
Super Communicators. Can you hold it up and show everyone? Because I see it right behind you.
Oh, sure. This is actually a blow up. Let me grab one. Hold on.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought that was the book.
No. It's like a blow up of the cover, but I have one right here too.
Move it a little to the this way. Great. Excellent. Okay. So those on the YouTube, you can see that. So let's just discuss the cover for a second. What was the logic behind that, and how does that tie to the topic of the book?
Well, we spent a lot of time, as you know, it takes a lot of time to figure out what the right cover is for a book. And
yeah,
I think that one of the things that happens with what we've learned about the science of communication is that these are skills that tend to build on each other, right? That our brains are basically have evolved to be excellent at communication, because communication is Homo sapiens' superpower. It's the thing that has allowed our species to succeed so well. And so with the cover, we thought it'd be kind of fun to signal this, like, building, that the fact that we learn to communicate as children, and as we get older, anyone can become a super communicator. It's just a set of skills that you just need to learn and allow to become habits. And once you do that, you can connect with anyone.
Yeah, I love that. And it's just something that any of us can cultivate in the set of skills. But there are super communicators out there that maybe it's a talent for, you know, because you can both computer at the same time. Something can be a source of variation that's a talent, and also we can all to some extent learn skills. These are the prodigies of super communicators. Maybe that's what I'm asking.
No, not really. And you're right. There are some people who are consistent super communicators. So we're all super communicators at one time or another. In fact, if I was to ask you, for instance, if you were having a bad day and you wanted to call mm-hmm. someone who you know would make you feel better, the person you would call, do they pop into your head? Who is
immediately
that?
Jordan Feingold, my co-author for my prior book, Choose Growth. Yeah.
Yeah. So Jordan, for you, is a super communicator, and you're probably a super communicator right back to him. You know exactly what questions to ask. You know
her.
You know her. Sorry, my apologies.
You're
a super communicator back to her, and you know what questions to ask and what you can hear the emotions underneath some of the things that she says that might not seem emotional on the surface.
Yeah.
And there's other times that you're super communicator when you walk into a meeting and you know exactly what to say to win the room over, or you a friend calls and you know exactly what to ask them. But there are some people who can do this more consistently. People who can essentially be consistent super communicator can connect with anyone. And when I first started doing the reporting for super communicators, I assumed kind of what you just said, that maybe these people were born with it, or maybe they're particularly charming or, you know, extroverts. But it turns out that's not right at all. In fact, what the research tells us is that anyone can become a super communicator, and it's essentially a random, you know, a normal distribution through society. There's some super communicators, consistent super communicators who are extroverts, and some who are introverts, or some who are charming and some who are curmudgeonly. It's not about an innate capacity you have. Rather, it's about a set of skills that you can learn. And if you talk to those people who are consistent super communicators, one of the things they often say is there was a time in their life when they were bad at communication, when, you know, they had trouble making friends in high school, or their parents got divorced and they had to play the peacemaker between them. And it's thinking about communication just even half an inch deeper than everyone else, than the average person, that makes us into super communicators, because the more we pay attention to how conversation works, the better we are at it.
Mm. Yeah, paying attention seems to be such an art. Carl Rogers, one of my heroes, wrote this wonderful book called Active Listening. I imagine that his technique to active listening would be quite relevant to being. I bet he was a super communicator, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I think he probably was. And I think a lot of what he wrote about in active listening and what others have expounded upon are at the core of these skills. And in many ways, what the skills are designed to do is to show the other person that you want to connect with them. Because oftentimes showing someone we want to connect by listening, by asking follow-up questions, by asking the right kinds of questions, by sharing things about ourselves and engaging in reciprocal authenticity and reciprocal vulnerability, those are the things that show the other person we want to connect with them. And that demonstration is often the first and most important step to actually making a connection.
Well, let's step back before we even get deeper in the weeds a second. And let's not in the weeds, but deeper into the topic. Let's step back a moment. Why are you personally? Why, you know, because you're a Pulitzer Prize winner, right? First of all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And you've covered various topics across your life. When did you start to get interested in this topic in particular? How did it get on your radar? And why are you personally interested in it? Yeah.
I think there was two things that happened. The first is I work at the New Yorker magazine now, but I was working at the New York Times and they made me a manager. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty good at like the logistics part and the strategy part of managing. And I figured I'd be a great manager because I've had lots of managers. I got an MBA from Harvard Business School. I figured this is something that I'd be good at. And I was just terrible at it. I was terrible at the communication part of it. You know, the people would come to me and they would, you know, sort of bring me emotional problems, and I'd try and solve their problems right away by giving them practical solutions. I didn't hear what they were really saying to me. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of bewildering to me to try and figure out why I was so bad at this, particularly because I'm a professional communicator. I'm a journalist. Yeah. And then I also fell into this bad pattern with my wife at home, which is that I would come home from work after a long day, and I would start complaining about my day, and, you know, my boss is a jerk. He doesn't understand me. And Liz, my wife, very reasonably would offer a practical suggestion, like, why don't you take him out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other a little bit better? And instead of being able to hear what she was saying, I would get even more upset. And I would say, like, why aren't you supporting me? You're supposed to be outraged on my behalf. And she would get upset because I was attacking her for giving me good advice. And so I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand why I was having these moments where I was bad at communication. And so I reached out to experts to ask them. And that was really the start of the book.
I love that. Well, you write about three types of conversations in this book.
Yeah.
What are they, and why is the distinction between them so important?
Well, this is what the researchers told me when I called them. They said two things. They said, first of all, we're really glad you called because we're living through this golden age of understanding communication for really the first time because of advances in neural imaging and in data collection. We can really study conversation like never before. And they said, and the big insight that we've had, or one of them, is we tend to think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about my day, or we're talking about grades or a new book that I had that just came out. But they said, actually, no, every conversation is made up of different kinds of conversations. And in general, they tend to fall into one of three big buckets. There's these practical discussions we have where we talk about plans or you know, solve problems together. Then there's emotional conversations where I might tell you what I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then finally, there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other in society and the social identities that are important to us. And what they said is, look, if you're not having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, it's very hard to hear each other. It's very hard to connect. And so this has become known as the matching principle, that communication relies on having the same kind of conversation at the same moment. And I thought that was really interesting because as soon as they told me this, it made clear what was happening with my wife, for instance. Like, I was coming home and I was having an emotional conversation and she was responding with a practical conversation. And those are both legitimate forms of conversation, communication. But because we weren't having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, it was really hard for us to hear each other. Whereas if we had been aligned, if we were having the same kind of conversation, then we could move from emotional to practical to social back to emotional together.
Yeah, I can clearly see how this is so important for relationships.
Yeah.
Partnerships, as you're describing, but any kind of relationship.
At work, you know, with your kids, even, you know, the barista you see every day, there's some element of why we connect or why we fail to connect that draws on this.
Yeah, I mean, the implications for this book are so wide-ranging relevant to the world today. My mind kept going back towards how can we use this in politics for politicians to be better super communicators as opposed to dividers. I don't know what another word for it could be, but I just see so many divisions right now and so many instances of people approaching conversations or relationships with their own frame of mind, with their own worldview lens. So do you think being part of a super communicator is being able to suspend maybe your narrow lens for a moment to be able to kind of incorporate and allow for an openness of a different perspective?
Well, the way I think about it is this, that I think super communicators understand the goal of a conversation. Okay. And the goal of a conversation is not necessarily to like convince you that you're wrong and I'm right, or to get you to agree with me, or even to convince you that I'm smart or you should like me. The goal of a conversation is to understand what the other person is trying to tell you and to speak in such a way that they can understand you. And once we establish that as our goal, it changes a lot of those things you were just talking about, right? Because I don't know if you need to be more open-minded or if you need to, but if I come and I say like, look, my goal in this conversation, the way I'm going to evaluate if this is a success or not, is to understand what you're trying to tell me. Then by virtue of that, I'm going to adopt some of your lens. I'm going to at least see the world through your lens. That doesn't mean that I agree with your lens, and it doesn't mean that I'm going to walk away and we're going to have found common ground. Right. But as long as I understand how you see the world, and I get you to understand how I see the world, then that conversation is a success. And I think there is a kind of open-mindedness that has to accompany that because it means that when I come into the conversation and you're saying things I disagree with, I'm not coming up with rebuttals in my head. That's not really listening. Rather, I'm coming up with questions. I'm coming up with with trying to understand what you're saying rather than tell you how wrong you are. And we know that actually people agree with each other more when they adopt this approach.
Yeah. But it also doesn't mean that you, there's going to be a lot of double negatives in this, but it also doesn't mean that there's not, that you can't disagree.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Right. That's part of helping you understand how I see the world, to say like, okay, what I hear you saying is you think that your candidate is the best for security. And I hear, am I getting that right? Am I hearing that? From my perspective, what's more important than security is justice. And so I'm choosing a candidate who I think brings more justice to the world. But these are both legitimate ways of looking at the world. And let me ask you some questions about how you think about security and justice.
Now, that is very idealistic. I love that, what you said. But with emotionally charged issues, I mean, I don't think people really think the other view is legitimate. You know, like, you know, if there's a conversation about reproductive rights, I couldn't imagine a conversation where someone's like, well, your view is, legitimate, but I just can't see that. I wish people could have more of a level-headed conversation, but the second you bring in emotions.
But we do this all the time, right? I mean, I imagine that there are probably some things that you're
married, you?
Right? No, I mean, humans.
We disagree. Like,
are you married? Yeah.
No.
Okay, but do you have a partner? Are you in like any relation? Like, do you have close friends? Anyone that you like talk to on a regular basis?
You're like, what can I ask that would be not too personal? Yes.
Okay. And so, do you agree 100% with your friends on everything?
No.
No. Of course not. And yet, you manage to be friends. You manage to navigate. And if one of your friends says, "Look, like," I think that Star Wars is much better than Star Trek, and you disagree. That doesn't mean you can't hear his reasons or her reasons for arguing that. And the same is true with reproductive rights. Oftentimes when we're having a conversation about something where we do feel very passionate about it, the fact that we feel passionate about it does not mean that we can't hear what the other person is saying. We can't try and hear what the other person is saying. Now, it does mean that sometimes we have to quiet that voice within our head and say, my goal here is to listen and understand. It's not to come up with counter arguments and like, you know, browbeat or bully this person into agreeing with me. But if you want to have a conversation, then you can absolutely have that conversation, even on things that you disagree with about that you feel very passionate about. Because the goal, again, is if you go in and you decide, like, I'm just going to like bowl this person over with my arguments, we know that's not going to work. You're kind of just wasting your time. But understanding what they're saying and helping them understand what you're saying, that's actually a conversation. That's communication.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the daily podcast from Hello Sunshine that is guaranteed to light up your day.
Every weekday, we bring you conversations with the culture makers who inspire us.
Ooh, like a recent episode with Melissa Joan Hart.
LL Cool J gave me some great advice. He had all these gold chains, and I was like, wow, look at all these diamonds. And he said something to the effect of, don't waste your money on something like this. Buy a house. Like, he gave me, like, solid investment advice where I was like, save my money, got it.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024,
And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time. We hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I'm all for this kind of very productive way forward, but it does take, I'm going to just say some trite things. It takes two to tango, and good, and it takes, I feel like there's a requirement here with two good faith actors. And I feel like that's just like a requirement for this to work. Like, if I'm having a conversation with a neo-Nazi who's not good faith, I mean, I don't know if it's going to work, to be honest.
I don't know that you're having a conversation in that case, to be totally honest. Right. With you. I mean, if you go into that conversation and you say, I want to have a conversation with a neo-Nazi, you can probably do it. But I think what you're actually saying, and tell me if you think I'm getting this wrong, is when I talk to a neo-Nazi, I don't want to have a conversation. I want to tell them how wrong they are. And that's totally fine. You don't have to have a conversation. Like, you know, there are many times that I say to my kids, I want to have a conversation about your room. And I don't actually want to have a conversation about their room. I want them to go clean up their room. So it's fine not to have a conversation. But if you actually want to have a conversation with a neo-Nazi, if you're going into this and you're saying, I'd like to understand how they see the world, because understanding how they see the world might help me figure out how to make my arguments more compelling to them, or it just might give me some insights on what's going on within the nation. You can do that, right? You have that capacity. Even if they don't necessarily want to listen to you, you have the capacity to listen to them. And here's the thing, is that we know this from studies. If you prove that you're listening, if you demonstrate that you are listening in good faith, they become much more likely to listen to you. In fact, we know that this like reciprocity of listening is such a strong social norm that people almost can't avoid it. So if you engage in this thing looping for understanding, where you ask a question, you repeat back what the person told you in your own words to show that you're really paying attention, you're processing it. You ask them if you got it right, which is them giving you permission to acknowledge that you've listened to them. The odds of them listening back to you go up astronomically.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking in this scenario that I wasn't the one open to the conversation. I was thinking they would be the one not open to the conversation, whereas your default was to think that I wasn't the one. Anyway, it's interesting. I think that what you're saying is true to an extent. If someone isn't, you know, you can really try you can be the best super communicator in the world, and there's still going to be people who are not open to having a conversation. And that's just the way the world, that's just what it is. You can't connect with everyone. Yeah.
You can't connect with someone who doesn't want to connect with you. But I'm just going to point out that if we look at history, or if we look at social sciences, what we see is overwhelming evidence of the alternative, of people who disagree about things coming together and figuring out how to live with each other peacefully and how to have conversations. I mean, think about the founding of America. The Constitutional Convention was essentially a group of people who hated each other coming together and disagreeing and figuring out how to have conversations so that they can write a constitution. I mean, the history of this nation is, and the history of the world in large part, at least the parts of the history of the world that we feel good about, are about how we can come together despite our differences, and we can have conversations. So you're right. There are some people out there who just want to get on Twitter and they just want to scream and they don't want to have a conversation. But the truth of the matter is that most of the people listening to this, They want to have a relationship with their neighbor, regardless of what lawn sign for which politician they have on their lawn.
Right.
They want
right.
to be able to go over and say like, hey, Jim, you know, what do you think about that pothole on the street? Can I borrow a hammer?
Yeah.
And we are very, very good at connecting with each other, even when we disagree about some things. And in fact, that's essential to human evolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a really good point. And the psychologist, Dr. Keltner, would agree with you.
Yeah.
So what are some common mistakes then that people make when talking with each other?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, right? So first of all is not trying to figure out what kind of conversation we're in. So, and this is a mistake that I've made regularly, right? When I was at the New York Times, someone would come to me and they would clearly be wanting to have an emotional conversation. They would want to talk about how they felt, that they were upset right. or felt disrespected or were frustrated. And instead of having that emotional conversation, I would often launch into a practical conversation and come up with all these practical solutions. And that's not what they wanted to talk about. They wanted to know that I understood what they were telling me before we moved together to a practical conversation. And one of the best ways to figure out what kind of conversation is happening is to ask questions, right? And in particular, to ask deep questions. And a lot of this comes from Nick Epley at the University of Chicago and the research he's done. A deep question is something that asks someone about their values or their beliefs or their experiences, which can sound kind of hard and intimidating, but it's actually very, very easy, right? If you bump into someone who's a lawyer, instead of asking like, oh, where do you practice law? You can ask, oh, what made you decide to go to law school? Like, what do you love about practicing the law? What's your favorite case? Those are questions that are deep questions that don't seem hard to ask. They're not overly intrusive, but they invite the other person to tell us something about themselves, how they see the world, what the experiences are that made them who they are. Those are really powerful. And so one of the big mistakes we make is that we don't ask questions. And if we ask questions, we tend to ask questions about facts, which are often dead ends. And a lot of this work comes from Mike Yeomans, who's at Imperial College right now, that when we ask about facts, oftentimes it's very hard to ask follow-up questions. We get into a dead end very quickly. But when we ask people how they feel about their life rather than the facts of their life, oftentimes they tell us something that's revealing about who they are, that's very easy to ask a follow-up question, and equally importantly, very natural for us to answer our own question. Oh, you became a doctor because, you know, or you became a lawyer because you saw your uncle get arrested? It's funny, I became a physician because my dad got sick when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Then we're engaging in that reciprocity, right? Where that back and forth that's so key to conversations. And so the top thing people can do is ask more questions and ask the right kinds of questions.
Do you think a good therapist is a good super communicator?
I think they can be, right? I mean, we both know enough. There are some great therapists out there, and there are some therapists who are less good at being super communicators. But there's also some super communicator lawyers out there, and professors, and doctors, and, you know, accountants. And there's some people who are less good at really trying to connect with other people. So I would say, in general, people who are therapists probably care more about connection. They're probably spending more time thinking about it, which is good. That's one of the things that we know super communicators do, is they think just half an inch deeper about communication. But being a therapist, I think, does not guarantee that you're a super communicator if you don't sort of remember some of the skills that are important.
But therapists could benefit from reading your book.
Perhaps. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of what a good therapist does in a session is the same skills that we describe in the book. And hopefully this gives people additional tools to use, you know, particularly when there's a portion of the book. There's a couple stories in the book. Like, one of the stories is about the CIA officer who's trying to recruit overseas assets and is terrible at it. And another portion of the book is about this conversation between gun rights advocates and gun control activists that goes very well in person and then falls apart when they go online. And some of the principles that allow for online communication to be better. And so I think anyone, therapist or not, can benefit from sort of seeing these examples and thinking a little bit more deeply about how our communication has to change as we move into different channels.
Well, I love the stories you bring. They're very wide ranging. Can we do you mind if we discuss some of the stories?
Of course. Yeah.
Some of my favorites. I liked the one about the Big Bang theory writer's room. Can you talk about it? It's really fun.
And just for anyone listening, it's the sitcom The Big Bang Theory, not the actual theory, The Big Bang Theory. So what's interesting about Big Bang Theory is like the most popular sitcom in history. Like, it's more popular than MASH, than Cheers. It's had more people watch it. It's lasted longer. It's won more awards. And what's funny is that when they first created that show, it was a total flop. Like, they actually created a pilot, and the pilot was terrible. Nobody liked the show at all. And the basic problem they had was the concept of the show is we are going to introduce all these characters who are physicists, except for one engineer, right? Everyone looks down at their nose at him, but the rest of them are physicists who are really, really bad at communication. Like, they're really bad at explaining their feelings. They're really bad at understanding other people's feelings. They're really bad at like just communicating. Most of them were male, communicating with women. And so the humor came from this miscommunication. The problem for a sitcom, though, is that the way that a sitcom works, the audience needs to understand what someone is feeling, like literally the second they appear on the screen. And if you're not clear on what each character is feeling, it's very confusing for you as an audience member. That's why sitcoms fail. And so, and just to give an example, like, we all know when we're watching a show, the difference between two people who love each other and two people who hate each other, and two people who are pretending to hate each other because they actually love each other and they haven't admitted it to themselves yet. Whoa. Right? We know that's like the premise of every single like sitcom. And we know within seconds of the person getting on the screen what's going on. Yeah. So the question for the Big Bang Theory writers was, how do we write a show where our characters are terrible at communication, but we need to communicate what they're feeling immediately? And they actually went to this research that had been done about how we display emotions and how we judge emotions, some of which had ended up influencing how NASA chose astronauts, which a little diversion. But when in the 1980s, NASA decided they needed to start finding astronauts who had more emotional intelligence because they were going to start building the space station and the missions were going to get longer, 6 months or 12 months. And so they said, like, look, we need astronauts who actually can connect with each other. And if not, they're going to drive each other crazy in this tin can in space for 6 months at a time. And they couldn't fit. But the problem is they couldn't figure out how to tell the difference between people who had emotional intelligence from people who faked it really, really well. Because when you make it to the final rounds of an astronaut interview, you're just like amazing, right? You have like a PhD and you're handsome and you're in great physical shape and you know how to answer every single question exactly the right way. So by the time you make it to the final rounds of an astronaut NASA interviews, you're really good at faking emotional intelligence, even if you don't have it. But they needed to find people who actually had emotional intelligence because you can't fake it for like 6 months at a time. Yeah. And they had these bad experiences during some missions. So this one guy, Terry McGuire, who's the lead psychiatrist for manned spaceflight, he comes up with a new way to interview people. When he walks into a room for the interview, he's carrying a big stack of papers and he spills them as if on accident. And then he laughs this huge boisterous laugh like, ha ha, I'm such a goo. I cannot believe I like, you know, dropped all these papers. And then he pays very close attention to how the astronaut candidate reacts because everybody laughs back, right? That's just social politeness. We know that, but some astronaut candidates would laugh like this. That's really silly. Here, let me give you a hand. And some of the candidates would go, ha ha, oh my gosh, that's crazy. Let me give you a hand. And what he realized is that the candidates who matched his emotional intensity, they were the ones who were emotionally intelligent. They were showing him that they want to connect. They were making this awkward moment feel easier for him. And they were the ones who ended up getting chosen. And that's what writers of the Big Bang Theory figured out, is that as long as the characters came on and they matched each other's energy and intensity and mood, it didn't matter what they said. The audience could tell whether these people were feeling connected with each other or weren't feeling connected. And that's all it took to make the show work.
Yeah, in that spirit, I'm going to respond to you. Yes, yes. I'll match you. Can I just tell you personally why I loved that out of all your stories the best?
Yeah.
I love that story the best out of all your stories. I think that a big problem with a lot of people on the autism spectrum, which I am a little bit on that spectrum myself, there can be a real problem in that matching, because we almost really just – there's not an automatic sort of we're very truthful, I don't know. Let me put a positive spin on it, because a lot of people put a negative spin on it. We don't like bullshit. We don't like, fat around things. We love to just get I'm very direct, right? And I think that I have had to learn over the years, and doing this podcast for 10 years, every week for 10 years, by the way, Charles, I've done this 10 years for every week. With no break, has taught me these skills that just – maybe don't come as naturally to me when I was born out of the gate. Yeah. So I think that the whole show is about these guys on the autism spectrum,
and it's important to note that the writers, I brought that up with the writers. I was like, well, the main character, he seems like he's on the spectrum, and they were like, no. And one of the writers is actually on the spectrum himself, and sort of very, very sort of proud, not proud, but he's very open about being on the spectrum. And when I mentioned this character being on the spectrum, he was like, no, he's never been tested. Like, we don't know if he's on the spectrum. You shouldn't put that on him.
Interesting.
But I think to your point, yeah, like, and the thing I would say is, we tend to be able to identify in neurodivergent individuals, having to learn skills very clearly. But the truth of the matter is, learning these skills is important even if you're not neurodivergent, because nobody's born with them. Some people are definitely born where it's harder for them to visualize the skills. It's harder for them to infer the skills from talking to others and pick them up socially. They need more explicit instruction about, to identify that skill. But nobody is born a super communicator. It's just that if we pay attention to communication, if it's something that we study a little bit and we see these skills, then we start to learn them and they become habits. And I would actually argue that folks who are neurodivergent, that in some respects, they pay more attention to conversations because those conversations are harder for them. And as a result, I think when the skills are made clear to them, when they get a chance to identify what they ought to be doing, much like you with this podcast, they become very, very good at it because it matters so much to them.
Wow, that just gave me a chill. Might be cold in this room. I don't know the source of that chill, but I...
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity. for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go, I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, fam. I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the daily podcast from Hello Sunshine that is guaranteed to light up your day.
Every weekday, we bring you conversations with the culture makers who inspire us.
Ooh, like our recent episode with Melissa Joan Hart.
LL Cool J gave me some great advice. He had all these gold chains, and I was like, wow, look at all these diamonds. And he said something to the effect of, don't waste your money on something like this. Buy a house. Like, he gave me, like, solid investment advice where I was like, save my money, got it.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love that, and I really am a firm believer in that principle that sometimes the people who lack the naturalness of certain things can end up far surpassing, you know, those.
Oh, absolutely. And we know this.
Yeah, we know
that, like, people who are consistent super communicators, they say there was a time in their life when they were bad at communication.
Wow.
When they were bad at making friends in high school, when their parents got divorced and they had to play the peacemaker between them. They had to think about conversation a little bit more deeply, and that's what made them a super communicator.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Along similar lines, I liked in the book how you talked about shy people.
Yeah.
So thank you for including them. If you're a shy person or you struggle, you know, just let's say introverted. Introversion is not the same thing as shy. But let's say you're someone who you don't articulate your thoughts out loud quickly. You like to step back and pause and think a little more. How can you still improve your odds of connection? You know, I'm a big fan of Susan Cain and all her work and that whole community. So any advice for that community?
Absolutely. There's been some really interesting research on this. And there's two things that I think. The first is, you know, part of communication is telling people how we best communicate. And so I've definitely been in conversations with people where they, you know, I'm talking a mile a minute and I'm coming up with all these ideas and they say, this is really, really interesting. I think I probably process a little bit differently than you. I just need a second to think through kind of what you're saying before I respond. Mm-hmm. And that's such a wonderful thing for people to say, right? Because they're telling me how they'd like to communicate, how they're most comfortable communicating. And when they do that, it not only helps the other person communicate with them, but it helps us see something about that, about them, right? It's an expression of authenticity and potentially vulnerability that gives us a chance to reciprocate. But then the second thing that often happens, and there's some research that's been done by these Harvard Business School professors that's really interesting, is they told the students, look, you're about to have a conversation with a stranger, okay? Someone from your class who you haven't met yet, which is like the most anxiety producing thing you can tell someone to do, right? Like, people hate being told they have to have a conversation with a stranger. And they said, okay, before you do it though, we want you to just take like 7 or 10 seconds and write down three topics you might want to discuss. Like dumb stuff, like, you know, like, have you seen the new Dune movie? Are you going to the football game this weekend? You know, things like that, just little things. And they said, okay, just write these down. Literally take 7 to 10 seconds, write these down, and then go have your conversation. And so people would write these down, they'd stick them in their pocket, and they'd go have the conversations. And the topics that they wrote down almost never came up. Mm. But afterwards, when the researchers asked the students how the conversations went, inevitably they would say things like, so much better than I expected. I felt so much more calm and like confident and like less anxious. And because I knew that like, if there was an awkward silence, I had this thing in my pocket, right? I had this backup topic that I could revert to. Yeah. And as a result, because I was less anxious, the conversation went a lot better.
Yeah.
And I think for introverts, or actually for any of us, there's kind of a lesson here, which is, if we just take 7 or 10 seconds before a conversation to think about what we might want to talk about, and in doing so, we're probably going to figure out for ourselves, like, you know, a little bit, what's our goal in this conversation? Is it to like learn something, or is it just to kind of like get to know someone? What's the mood that we hope to establish? Do we want this to be formal or informal? If we just take a little bit of time to think about a conversation before the conversation starts, research shows the conversation goes much, much better. And I think particularly for people who are shy, this is something that helps manage that social anxiety a little bit.
Yes. What about for people who they have trouble with social cues with the what is unsaid? You know, like that may seem like that's like a panic attack for some people to say, well, you have to pay attention to what's unsaid. It's like, well, how do I know what's unsaid?
Right, right. Well, oftentimes, so oftentimes simply saying that I want to pay attention to what goes unsaid, I want to pay attention to someone's expressions, I want to pay attention to their gestures, how they're holding their body, their tone of voice. Simply telling ourselves like this is something you should remember to do actually makes us much, much better at it. So it's not that there's some people who are just bad at picking up on nonverbal or non-linguistic cues. It's just that there are people who have not prioritized that and haven't practiced it. But then the second thing is, I think, again, asking those questions. You know, Nick Epley, I mentioned him from the University of Chicago. He does this thing where he'll like get on buses and he'll go and talk to strangers. And his goal is to get people to people's hopes and dreams in like two or three questions. And so he'll ask them like, you know, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm an accountant. Oh, did you always want to be an accountant? Was that your dream when you were a kid? And I think that when we ask questions like that, what we do is we give the other person an opportunity to say the things that might go unsaid. Right. If someone's like, oh, I'm an accountant, and we ask, did you always want to be an accountant? Then like what we're doing is we're giving them a chance to say like, no, I actually wanted to become like a movie star, or to say, or if they're like, I'm an accountant, and we're like, did you always want to be an accountant? Yeah. I love numbers. I love helping people. Like, I think that we often expect that people should be able to hear what goes unsaid without also the corollary, which is, oftentimes you can simply ask people to say what is unsaid, and that helps illustrate for you. And by the way, they love being asked.
That's great. That's great tangible advice. So a lot of this is learning the ways that you can talk so that people want to listen to you. You know, like if they're tuning out or whatever, that's not a good start for a conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a lot of ways, I like your framing. I mean, you could have called this book How to Win Friends and Influence People. But first of all, that title is taken already. And second of all, that's not the spirit of the book. You know,
no,
it's just, you know what I mean? But a lot of these skills, you know, are, you know, there's some overlap, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we know, I mean, and you know, this research literature. Like, if your goal is to win friends and influence people,
right?
Let's take, you know, politics. There's been a bunch of really interesting research lately in how to change people's opinions on politics. And for a long time, the conventional wisdom was just give them the facts, right? Like, if I can go in and I can just show them that, you know, same-sex marriage is as stable as mixed-gender marriage, if I can show them that the vaccines are safe and they have nothing to worry about, then they'll change their mind. And of course, that isn't actually true, right? We saw that during the pandemic.
Right. Oh, yeah.
NIH at the beginning of the pandemic said for vaccine-resistant individuals, what you should do is you should just give them the evidence. And all the doctors who work with these populations are like, are you crazy? Like, these people have more evidence than they know what to do with. They spend days researching online and like reading studies. It's not that they're lacking evidence or data. It's that's the wrong conversation to have. And so the right way to have that conversation, whether it be political issues or whether it be, you know, vaccinations, is to engage in this thing known as motivational interviewing, right? Where I go to you and I say like, look, I'm wondering, I'm going from door to door talking about same-sex marriage. I'm wondering if you could tell me what you think about same-sex marriage. And then just let the person talk and then prove that you're listening. Say like, what I hear you saying is this, and I want to make sure I'm getting this right. That doesn't mean I agree with them, but I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Did I understand you correctly? And when we hear their story, when we hear how they see the world, and then we're able to share how we see the world alongside it, very often what we find are things where we're in we're in agreement with each other, where there's commonalities. You know, you care about, like, you're against same-sex marriage because you think that, you know, marriage is so important to society and that, that stability is important. And it's interesting because my uncle is gay and he's been with his partner for 30 years. And all they want is that same stability. They want to be able to be seen as stable by the people around them. And that doesn't, again, that what we know is that if you engage in this, if you ask questions, if you listen, if you try and understand, if you put your own experiences alongside someone else's experiences, you only end up changing their mind like 3 to 5% of the time. But in politics, changing someone's mind 3 to 5% of the time is astronomical, right? Most races are decided by 3 to 5%.
Totally.
And the same thing is true with vaccine rates. We've seen again and again and again that the best way to take people who are vaccine resistant and make them and help them consider the vaccine and get a vaccine is simply to listen and understand why they're resistant. And rather than telling them that they're dumb or wrong, to explain how we see the world.
Charles, we got to get you on Rogan. How do we get you on Rogan? How do we get you on Rogan? Oh, my man. It is such a delight to chat with you. Let's not go another 8 years without talking to each other.
I love it. Let's absolutely do it again soon.
Love the vibe. I just love the positivity of it that we all can learn these skills.
Yeah. And congratulations on the show. I mean, I didn't realize it had been 10 years. Like, that's a real accomplishment. That's a lot of knowledge brought into the world.
Thank you so much. I started in 2014, so we're coming up on the 10th year anniversary this year, and you were on it, the second year, was it 2016? You were on it the second year. Yeah. Well, thanks again, Charles, and all the best with the book tour.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.